Good morning, everyone. It is great to be here. I get to say with many of my fellow New Yorkers for about another 2 months, and then I'm off to South Carolina, where I will talk slower. I used that joke once, and this is going to be it's going to be trouble already. I used that joke once. I was at a conference, and I was looking to sit for lunch, and Paul Jones was there from the University of North Carolina. I said, "Up, bunch of Southerners, I'll just talk slower." He said, "You know, it has been my experience that people from the North do, in fact, speak quickly, but they share a lot of blank bits." And so it is also nice to be down in Brooklyn. I get to have every Easter down with my in-laws, and so I get to hear the lovely homily that starts with, "So Jesus is like poked with this stick, and he's bleeding like crazy." And I'm just like, my people. Welcome. So today, I love the theme as well, weird library science, and I decided to go probably way too into that. And so rocket science is easy. I would love to say that I came up with this, but I stole this from my advisor at one point, Mike Eisenberg, and he was sitting in a meeting and he's like, "Oh, rocket science? Library science is hard. Rocket science is easy. You know, you shoot a rocket, it hits the moon, you win. Library science, you know." So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on what I mean by that, because it's actually sincere, and it doesn't show up the way many people think, because many of you may know me from a book or hearing me on the web, and I get to play my library cheerleader all the time, but I'm going to, it turns out I have a day job, and my day job is as an information scientist. Isn't that very exciting? I have a degree in science. They gave me a PhD, which means, by the way, I do have the compulsory picture of professor in front of technology. And I am legally authorized to use graphics that mean nothing. Because right? That's what, you know, when we think about information science, it's information. We all know what that is, sort of, right? And so it becomes a little convoluted, and are we talking about this or that and such? But ultimately, what information science is, which I see as really an outgrowth of library science, is the notion that we look at how people become informed. We look at how we process things, et cetera. And it's an applied social science. And so we're going to need to spend a little bit of time, if we will, talking about science, because I think it has implications. So I'm going to ask for your indulgence, because from time to time, there will be statistics on the screen. And don't worry, they'll go away soon. But I want to build up on this idea, for example, that rocket science is easy. And this is not just me. This is NASA that's going to tell you that rocket science is easy. Because if you put into a lovely Google search rocket science, one of the first links you'll get is to a page that looks like this. Now, you look at this, and many of us, a few of us are going, "Yeah, motion, Newton's third. Fourth law, I think. Second law, I got that one wrong." Right? And many of us are looking at this going, "Oh crap, is this an hour?" Right? I'm not going to walk you through this equation, because I actually can't walk you through this equation, but my 16-year-old who does model rockets actually has been computing using this stuff since he was in eighth grade. And my point of this is all that wonderful big red equation is rocket science. It is quite literally how you determine how far a rocket is going to go based on how much of a payload you put in. You put in the variables of, for example, how much mass is it, how much fuel have you put in, what's the propulsion, what's the speed of the propulsion, and you can compute within a pretty interesting narrow range how high the rocket goes. Now, the reason I bring that up is because when many people see this, they look at this and they think this is a hard problem. And that's because for many of us, mathematics is a hard problem, but which is, by the way, probably more societal in its making than anything else. It is actually somewhat cool to get up and say, "Oh, math was really tough. I don't know math," right? We can make jokes about that. But in essence, math is an approach that is really interesting. This is an example of a simple problem. Doesn't look it, but it is. So what do I mean when I say a simple problem? Let's talk for a moment about the different types of problems that we encounter as a society and as individuals. And the first are simple problems. A simple problem is where the outcome is known. We want this rocket to get to this planet. We want this rocket to go this high. We want this rocket to do this. We know what our goal is. And the process is also known. In order to do that, I run this equation, I will find an answer, right? So not only do we know how to find the answer, we can check the answer, but we kind of know what the answer is. So it's a simple problem. And life is full of lovely, simple problems. So someone once put it, when I give you a key to a car, it's a relatively simple thing. You understand it, you know how to use it, it's a pretty concrete thing. So simple problems. We have simple problems, we love simple problems. Will the coffee be here? How do we get in the elevator, etc. The next kind of problem, and this is where I think people often get confused, is they look at complicated problems. Now, a complicated problem still usually has a known outcome. And the process, while if not known, is discoverable. What does that mean? Well, that rocket. If anyone is a science geek like me, did you see the rocket land on the platform yesterday? Right? So all these commercial rocket companies are sending them out and they're landing them, and it's like, you know, Star Trek is born, it's great. And it's a complicated problem because it's not quite like that equation. You can put all the equations you want, but there's all this stuff that you're going to miss. So just getting it landed, et cetera. How do we put the fuel cells? How do we deliver it? Does it change temperature? Does it matter at where we are above sea levels? There's lots and lots of variables, but we can work through them. And life is full of complicated problems. But I want to focus today on the last type of problems, which is complex problems. Complex problems are where the outcomes are often emergent. In other words, we don't necessarily know what the answer is or what even that we're looking for. If 1970, no one got up at a library science conference and said, the big trend is going to be makerspaces. What does that mean? Well, what you're going to do is take a hot glue gun, attach it to a bunch of gears, and hope for the best, right? And from a five-year-old's perspective, and produce toys that are crap because you can buy them cheaper in mass market, right? That idea of we didn't know. We live in a field, in a discipline where outcomes are emergent. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, right? We have this lovely stability. When we look at things like circulation counts, and we say that we don't have an outcome, but we really have an outcome because we don't want it to be less than last year, right? But we're not quite sure. Where is it going to be? What's affecting it? How are we going to make it bigger, less, et cetera, all this other stuff? They're emergent problems. The other is that the process itself is variable. How we get to those emergent problems, we're not quite sure. So the example here is simple problem. How do we determine thrust, et cetera, the equation for height, altitude of a rocket? Complicated. How do we actually build a rocket that will function? Complex. How do we get kids to give a damn about rocketry? Right? We talk about STEM education, and then we like soften it because we say STEAM because arts are important. Arts are essential. I mean, just adding the A into STEM is just a sort of hand toss, right? Because STEM, we say, well, it's important. Everyone's got to know science. Everyone's got to do this. But we don't necessarily know how to get them involved. We don't necessarily know how to push it. We in library land have been for centuries in the literacy business, in reading and such. We have an outcome. We want people to be good readers. We want them to love reading. First of all, as an outcome, that kind of stinks. Not that it's bad that they should love reading, but try and measure it. How much do you love reading? Right? I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, this is...
You love reading? Really? A lot? More than me?
Next annual report. They loved reading and they broke under interrogation. So we're not quite sure. But then the process. How do we get people to love reading? Well, normally you give them a book they love. Radical idea, right? But even then we deal with things like, but do they have dyslexia? Are there other barriers? Are there cultural barriers? Are there monetary barriers? What are the other barriers that go with this? That idea of how we get to it, how we get Dave Lankus to love reading in Syracuse and how we get, you know, someone else to love it in Brooklyn and someone else to love it in China isn't the same. So they're complex problems. So I want to spend some time today with this following thesis, because I'm a scientist, so it's a thesis. It's not just this is the crap I want to talk about. It's a thesis. The thesis is that librarianship is about solving a community's complex problems. Furthermore, that librarians use simple, complicated, and complex tools to do this. We are tool users and we are tool builders. And one last part of the thesis, that continued relevance of librarians comes from a focus on complex problems. That for many of us, what we have been doing and what we've been spending time and what we worry about really comes down to the notion of complicated problems, sometimes simple problems. And that as we looked at other people and said, oh, they're taking our territory, are we still relevant, are we still blah, 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 comes because people see the problems that we are addressing as either simple or complicated, not realizing that, in fact, they are very complex. Let me give you an example of that, because oftentimes people equate complexity with technology. That when I say, hey, we're dealing with complex problems, the assumption is that we're dealing with more and more increasingly complicated problems. Right? That simple problem, all right, we've gotten rid of those, but now we're taking on the hard ones, so they're complicated. And they get harder and harder. So complex is at the top of the spectrum, so it must just be more and more complications, more and more complications. But that's not how it works. For example, let's take our buddies at Google. Google is solving a complicated problem, and it's doing it extremely well. And when people look at what Google does, we get sort of scared. We get sort of awed in some places by the complexity, but really the complicatedness, I don't know what the adjective is, of the problems they're solving. They have lots of servers. They eat lots of power. They have wires and lights and things and ooh, ah, it must be complex. But that room that they're in, the room that you're seeing, which is server and server and server and server, is the ultimate definition of a complicated problem. What I mean is it's scalable. Once they figure out a problem, they're able to scale it. This is why, for example, Amazon.com that everyone looks at and says, oh, they must be selling lots of books, makes the majority of their money not selling books, materials, or yard rakes, but makes it selling computing power through their cloud services. When you watch Netflix, you're watching it via Amazon's cloud. Why? Because they realize that this is a complicated problem. How do you get them wired? How do you balance? How do you hook them up? But they're scalable. We just add more and more servers and more time, more and more power, and we can deal with it. And the example is that this entire infrastructure, this very complicated infrastructure, which is astounding and a marvel of engineering. I want to be really clear. This is a marvel of engineering in terms of computing technology, in terms of power utilization, in terms of network bandwidth, in terms of software. It's a marvel. But it comes down to something that's very simple. That entire infrastructure is built initially to do this. This is the PageRank algorithm done in smiley face. Because really, do no evil and smiley faces should go together. Of course, it should also go together with business practices, but we'll get there later. All right, so PageRank, for those of you who haven't cared, frankly, the big thing that Google did was not invent the search engine. There were plenty of web search engines before it. What they did was they got it right. What they realized very early on is that when we deal with a concept in information science called relevance, that is, how likely is this to satisfy your need, when we're dealing with the web, our traditional way of looking at relevance wasn't working. The traditional way of looking at relevance is you type in a query, and the more words, the better. And we rip that query apart. We take it, we find the important words, we throw out the words we don't like to and we put them together in combinations, and we run this through a big index, and it pops back documents. And the problem is this wasn't working well on the web. It was working just about as well as it works in most of our databases that we license, which we know means not well, right? So what two doctoral students coming out of California realized is, hey, the web's different. It isn't just a matter of the words that are bunched up in those pages. They're all pointing to each other. And it turns out that if you do things like the yellow circle is pointed to the most, and that matches your query, it's most likely to be relevant. And those blue, those little green ones, they're interesting and they match your query, but they're not as potentially interesting as blue and red, etc. And if you're pointed to by really important ones, you get important. And this whole algorithm came down to the idea that you look at the web You look at the links. The things that are linked to most are important, and the things that they link to are important, and you come up with a lovely little equation. It is mind-bogglingly simple in its execution, or rather in its concept as an algorithm. In its execution, it is mind-bogglingly complicated, because how do you do that with trillions of websites? Marvel of engineering. But it comes down to this. Now, you may already know that it turns out this is a very, 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 very old graphic, because I think about the third day they began taking into account things that were paid for, things that were commercial. Then they began doing things like where you are, what technology you're on, who you're sleeping with. Anyway, sorry. I just went into the tinfoil hat part of my life. We'll get to that later. And we know that this is a complicated solution to a problem, but we know that it doesn't truly master the complexity because popularity, page rank, the most important thing, isn't always sufficient to solve a very complex problem, which is information seeking, when we seek information. And anyone that has ever had to do research to know the difference between an apple and an apple knows that this simple problem and a complicated solution doesn't solve the complex problem, right? If you search for apple in Google, you'll get stuff about computers. If you search for apples, plural, you'll get stuff about the fruit. Why? Because that's how the words worked, and that's the page algorithm. More people were talking about the technology. We've seen Google bombing, right? Love Google bombing. Pick something you hate, write lots of pages that use that key term and point to it. We can play this algorithm because it is complicated, but it is not truly complex. And so what librarians do when we do information seeking and reference work and all this wonderful stuff, and by the way, information organization, cataloging, subject identification, collocation, is try and go beyond an algorithmic approach and try and provide a complex solution. That is that people in Brooklyn, as was just talked about, can be slightly different than people in Palo Alto. Right? We see this all the time. People in Silicon Valley have a view of what your life is like, and people on the street living in different parts of the world have very different views. And so simply saying, well, I'm here, isn't a matter of finding the closest pizza place. It means that your attitudes may be different, your perspectives may be different, the challenges that you have different, your history may be different, your cultural and family situation may be different. That complexity is where librarians come in. So, complexity is different. You must think differently when you are solving complex problems. That means as librarians, we must think differently. So, another information science example. A complicated way of thinking about the world is through something called analysis of variance. ANOVA. Everyone going back to their library science program went, oh, crap. Right? Multilinear regression analysis. And this kind of approach, the way it works is you sort of look at a situation. Situation could be anything from a physical state, can be social state, can be whatever. How many people go to the library? What type of people go to the library? You look at things like the Pew Internet Research that talk about who goes to the library, who's our library supporters. You look at that data, they use this type of statistical analysis. And I want to be clear, this is an amazing leap forward. When statistics first became utilized in how we did science and then social science in the 1800s, it changed the world. It took it from, I think, to, it seems. And the way this works is you identify a phenomenon, you identify a set of variables, independent variables that don't change, and dependent variables that will change based on what you do to the independent variables, right? So you play this game. And then what you do is you go and you test it. You find out what you're doing, you find out what you're doing, you find out what you're doing. Then you make some change and you go back and see if there's a difference. This is why we get things like cholesterol bad. Because we looked at lots of people, we looked at their cholesterol ranking, we ran them through this equation, and we found that the amount of cholesterol in your blood has this association, a statistically significant, by the way, there is no such thing as very significant, it either is or isn't, statistically significant link to heart disease. It also points out, at that example, the limitations of this, which is if you don't get all the variables or you don't get the right variables, then you get what I call the chocolate study phenomenon. How many people think that chocolate is good for you? dark chocolate is good for you. How many people think, yeah, right. How many people have seen 5 studies in the past 5 years that have told you it is, and it isn't, and it is, and it isn't, and you stop paying attention? Right? That's the problem with a complicated approach, is it works really well in a well-defined environment where you understand the variables, but it doesn't work very well if you don't know what all the variables are. Or you don't account for all the important variables. For example, if I were going to talk about your performance review, and you're going to come in and I'm going to watch you today, right? I can look at all the variables. Well, this was their training, this was their hours on staff, this is their past performance. Right? I can get all the variables. And I look at you, and all this says that you should be performing in an outstanding manner. And you come in and you just rip a patron apart. That is a really stupid question, and I'm offended that you asked. Right? What happened? All my variables, what happened? Well, what happened is you woke up that morning and your tire was flat. Or you woke up and you had a big argument with your kids because God knows they're always ready to go on time, right? Or you were coming in and it rained and it did all these things that put you in a bad mood. And you walked in and none of those variables were accounted for. We see this in testing again and again and again. What's the problem with high-stakes testing? One of the 2 major variables that determine your success in high-stakes testing. One, how you deal with the stress of taking a high-stakes test, right? Which is determined by taking the test. Welcome to Catch-22. Number 2, zip code. We know very well that people perform well on the SATs when they come with a zip code that is normally in a suburban environment. Frankly, is normally in a suburban environment with above average income, and frankly, is normally of a certain ethnic race. We know that. That in this country, right now, people's future is being determined more by where they are born than the character and nature of what they do. This doesn't capture that. It simply draws the picture. Right? What this gives you in a complicated way is it says, great, this is easy. We simply won't test the people in Brooklyn. Now you laugh, but guess how many schools used to make it through their performance evaluations with states and whatever? Oh, I'm sorry, Bobby can't come to school today. I'm sorry, you can't take this test. Right? We know that this doesn't count for all the variables because what happens is, as you begin to break it down, there are an infinite number of variables, and we can't account for infinity in math. It doesn't work. So a complicated approach where we do things like, how do we improve our service? Well, let's go survey 300 people and get the average. Does that make sense when those 300 people are very different people? A complex approach in terms of science can be indicated by things like hurricane forecasting. See, statistics, hurricane forecasting. It's a new day. Many of you have probably seen a map something like this. I apologize. Right? Which is, where's the damn hurricane going? This is quite literally called a spaghetti model of hurricanes. And if there is a better image than a hurricane of spaghetti for a children's book, I don't know what it is. Right? And the reason is that when we do weather, is it going to rain today? At what time is it going to rain? What's it going to be like on Thursday? Blah, blah, blah. That problem is so complex that we can no longer statistically model it with dependent and independent variables. There are so many variables that go into this that the way of doing this by running numbers doesn't work. And so what happened is we developed a new emergent set of methods, statistical methods, Bayesian statistics, complexity theory, complex adaptive system modeling, etc. We developed a whole new world of how to understand this problem. And the way it goes is exactly the opposite of how the complicated version is. Complicated is you look out at existing variables and you make a determination. I just had a Bernie Sanders moment. I'm sorry. You look out and you get all the data and then you make inferences. You make deductions, pardon me. In the complex way, you do it the exact opposite. You collect as many variables as you can and then you project forward. You model. You simulate. So the reason we don't know where the hurricane is going is because we know we don't have enough information. There's just too much information on wind shear and temperature and who's there next day and what happened in Guatemala 3 years ago and what's happening with the dust storms and El Nino. We know we can't capture it, so we get as much as we can. And we drop it into a model and we say, play forward. And what happens in weather forecasting model is the first hour, we have about a 99% chance of getting it right. By the time we're at the end of the first day, we're at about a 90% chance of getting it right. By the end of the second day, we're down to 50% chance. And if you ever look at a 7-day forecast and make a plan based on it, you are crazy. The Weather Channel said they're going to start coming out with 30-day forecasts. Yay! I mean, I don't want to say that the Weather Channel is a problem. It's just, it turns out Benjamin Franklin did it a couple hundred years ago called the Farmer's Almanac, and it's just about as accurate. All right? So what you're seeing, this craziness, is their best guess. They're modeling it. They can't tell Charleston if it's coming or New York if it's coming because for all they know, it's out of here. Right? And that's why they have to model it. Well, if we are solving complex problems, we need to move our minds from gathering data and seeing what is to begin modeling and picturing what could be or what should be or how we move forward. Because here's the dirty little secret, and it's not so dirty and it's not so little. So here's the obvious fact, which is the minute you introduce these things into any equation, it breaks. People are complex. People, when they act, when they make decisions, when they make choices, when they buy something, when they support something, when they vote, when they come into a library, when they don't come into a library, when they go to Uber or don't go to Uber, blah, 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 don't act in a logical, simplistic, complicated way. They do it in a complex, crazy, what the hell kind of way, right? As an example, here, how many people have done a survey? How many, don't do them anymore. How many people, we'll get there. How many people did something like ask on the survey what someone's gender was? How many people have been watching what's happening in North Carolina? Right? Gender, sexual orientation, race, religion, political preferences. These used to be considered variables that were discoverable and finite. They were independent controlled variables. We were supposed to be able to tell you this is what men think and this is what women think. We were supposed to be able to tell you this is what blacks and Latinos and whites and Chinese and think because we knew how it worked. This is what a Republican does. God, what does a Republican do? And for those listening at home, we used to know. I mean, actually, I'm going there. When you saw when Donald Trump entered this contest, every person on the world went, great, I cannot wait. Now everyone's going, oh my God! Because what we thought was political preference, what we thought we understood, we did not because people do crazy crap. I mean really crazy crap. The best crap ever. Anyway, all right. So as librarians, when we think about the problems, when we think about the solutions, when we think about what we do, we must also think in a complex way. We must think differently than how we've been doing it. This becomes particularly true that as we have seen the focus of librarianship change dramatically, the focus of librarianship in preparation, library science schools, in orientation, library staffing, library volunteer preparation, all of this was focused on these things, a collection. I mean, originally books and manuscripts and documents and now databases and web pages and materials and etc., but it was on things. Things that don't have gender. It's lovely. Right? Things that don't have race. Is that a black book? No, it's kind of purple. Right? Or at least, and I want to be really clear, we pretended that they weren't complex. But that focus, when you look at library science, if you look at library science education, you look at the documents, you look at journal articles, and you look at that trace back to about 1980, it's all around the notion of a social science dealing with complicated problems where they're doing lots of statistics and variables. The place this showed up brilliantly was in information retrieval. How many people in your library science education had a lovely section on Boolean algebra? And how many people say, huh? And, or, nor, zor? My favorite is XOR. I mean, exclusive OR. Damn, that's cool, right? But the idea was that we could, through literally algebra, figure out what documents are most relevant to you. That's what we looked at before. We looked at characteristics of use. We looked at what systems work. We looked at it in a complicated way, but in a discoverable way. Now, as librarianship is getting back to what it's always been about, which is the collection is really the community that we serve, those are just tools up there, life changes. In the complicated world, we dealt with things like metadata and metadata assignment, and should we do things like RDA, and should we do things like Ferber? I just like saying Ferber. Actually, the sentence I really like saying is forget Ferber, but Ferber, right? Where we believed that we understood an extant, discoverable, and descriptive way that documents are related. That somehow we understood that if we broke the world from a book into works and manifestations and et cetera, that we could out-complicate this problem. This is Dewey Decimal World, right? If I just have a hammer that is big enough and divided into 10 sections, I can classify the world. And we believed, because it had statistics and data and science, that we were doing it in an objective, neutral way, even though we weren't. Want to know why? Go look at the religion section of Dewey Decimal and figure out, I wonder if Dewey was a Christian. And anti-Semitic and misogynist. Yes. But we approached metadata as if it was copy cataloging is built on the foundation that if you describe it in Brooklyn, you describe it in Syracuse, and you describe it in Shanghai, it's the same. Really? One's local history, one's foreign affairs, and one's, I don't know, right? Retrieval. Once again, all based on if I can get the variables and break the variables together. We dealt with collocation. How do these things come together with classification? What's the coverage of classification? We dealt with coverage. Are we getting sufficient coverage? Literary warrant. Are we looking at enough of the literature? We look at preservation, which is, and I want to be really clear, these are complicated, hard problems, but they're discoverable. We know that if we can keep a document around for 300 years, we got a good solution, right? So we look at that. Provenance, document delivery. You know why I love Google most? It solved a very complicated problem that librarians had called document delivery. When people called up on the phone and asked us a question, we can now literally just push Google and send them to Google and whatever, and it solves this vast array of problems that we no longer have to worry about. Very complicated problems that they can deal with. It frees us up to deal with complex problems. Complex problems like learning. I really don't care about the love of reading. I will say it again. I do not care if you love reading. I care if you can read. Right? Reading to me is an essential skill. It's an essential skill not simply for surviving in the economy. It's an essential skill for developing as a human being, engaging new thoughts and ideas, developing imagination, developing concentration, developing analytical skills. Those to me are essential skills. Now, ask me to measure them. Ask me to measure them in a way that I can report to a board or a president or a borough that needs to come up with our funding. Right? So what do? Circulation. What do? Love of reading stories. But it's a complex problem. How do we get kids to read? How do we get them in makerspaces? How do we get them to discover? How do we get parents to read? How do we deal with the fact that so much focus on STEM education is dealing with our children that we have an entire population from immigrant population to simply people who have already graduated high school to a whole swath of people who need to benefit from a STEM economy as adults, and we have no focus, no understanding, and no funding to make that happen. How do we deal with that problem? That is a complex problem. How do we deal with identity? Right? I got yesterday, thanks very much, a Brooklyn Public Library card. This is the little version. It's very exciting. Right? So, okay, I now, within BPL, have an identity. What else do you need to know about me? Where do you keep it? Does it matter? Can you share it? Where can we put it? Am I able to use it in a transactional way? What do I mean? Can I now use this to find out every book that I have ever checked out of the Brooklyn Public Library? No. Why? Privacy, right? Because privacy is important. And yet, if I go to Amazon, I can. And that's a value to me. And does that mean that I'm giving up some of my privacy to get that value? Yes. Is that something we need to think about rather than simply having identity or not identity, yes, no, privacy, no, if we begin to think of it as a complex problem? What transaction, what negotiation are we willing to have with the people we serve to get them better service, realizing that there are going to be compromises? That is a complex problem. Dealing with notions of aspirations. We're really good at finding deficiencies. Oh, we have low reading here. We have low participation over here. This is a high poverty area. I come from Syracuse, New York, and you might go, oh, Syracuse, yeah, that's a city, right? We have the highest per capita level of poverty and segregation in Syracuse than the national average, regardless of city. We have starker problems around the questions of poverty and racial discrimination in Syracuse, New York, than you do in Brooklyn, than you do in Queens, than you do in Manhattan. Okay? How do we fix that? That's great. But how do we move beyond it to say fixing it doesn't mean turning people into this person? Doesn't mean making everyone a suburban white kid. Right? It means, what do we want to be? Do we want to be a high income area where we support entrepreneurs and business? Do we want to be a high literacy area where it's all about education and reading? Where do we want to be? That's what it comes down to, is dealing with this question. Where am I, by the way? Oh, good, I'm fine. Where do we want to be? What do we dream about? It used to be in the Middle Ages, villages would build cathedrals. They built cathedrals not simply to praise God, but because they were economic development engines, because now the pilgrims had to come your way to see the left fingernail clipping of St. Augustine on Thursday, and that brought in economy, and that brought in people, and that brought in trade. We don't build cathedrals in this country anymore. We build libraries. If you look at how we build libraries, you look at everything from Seattle Public Library's new building to Salt Lake City's to what they did in San Francisco. We built libraries not simply as a service. We built them as spires and dedications to the aspirations of learning of our communities. We built them as economic engines, but we also built them so that everyone in our community could go, that's me. All right, what does your community aspire to? What does Brooklyn aspire to? What does Queens aspire to? What does Boston aspire to? What are their dreams? And how do you deal with the fact that some people are dreaming this way and some people are dreaming that way? That is a complex problem. And if we can't develop a narrative around our communities, they will be imposed upon us. What we have seen in Ferguson, Missouri, what we have seen in Baltimore, is when there is civil unrest and an outcry, it is instantly turned into, by national media, a flattened racial discussion, which is all about us versus them. When, in fact, when you go into it, you find out the true narrative of a community, which is about learning and opportunity and access. When Baltimore and central Baltimore was torn apart in response to police misdeeds, that community lashed out. And in doing so, they eliminated access to public facilities, food, and diapers. And so when the public library opened, their main issue where they were getting money and they were getting resources and what they were thinking is, how do we build now access to the justice system? How do we give out diapers? How do we give out aid to move ahead? How do we now lobby for public transportation to create more opportunity? Those are complex problems, folks. But they're essential at the center of our community, not to the side. Governance, how do we govern ourselves? Sense-making. How do people make sense of the information we give them? Complex problems. And if we as librarians don't begin to realize we're in that business, and that business is hard, and that business is important, and it takes professionals and preparation and expertise and bring our communities along, then more and more of the complicated problems will be solved for us, and they don't need us. Google did not put libraries out of business. It wasn't because they didn't solve a complicated problem that libraries were working on. They did. It was because the purpose of the library was not that complex problem. That complex problem needed to be solved to help us to the larger complicated problem to get to the complex problems, right? Google didn't put us out of business because that wasn't our business. That's our business. Complex approaches. So how does this change how we address our field? First, we have to deal with the them problem. If you've heard me before, you know where it's coming. What do we call them? Those people who come into our doors who are lined up at 9 o'clock for our opening, what do we call them? Do we call them users? Do we call them customers? Do we call them members? Do we call them patrons? First of all, how many people feel that you serve your users well? How many of you feel enjoy being used? All right, let's try consumer now. How many people, right? These words mean something. These words mean something. And in complicated and simple problems, the simplest way, the best way to make a solution is you simplify. And the easiest simplification that has existed in this field for far too long is us and them. Producer, consumer, patron, librarian, people who work here, people who don't work here. And then we've done it to our own profession. Library staff, librarians, right? Administration, workers, right? Academic librarians, public librarians, this divide by, we divide the world. That is a solution for a complicated problem, not a complex problem. Why do I keep pushing the idea that they are members? And by the way, if you would rather use the word neighbors, I'm all for it. If you would rather use the word allies, which they use in Italy, fabulous. If you want to use Dave and call them by name, even better. But when we use terms like users, we are adopting a whole baggage of concepts from people solving complicated problems, not complex problems. Because what we know is that the relationship we have with the people in our community is complex. It is not as simple as those who pay and those who don't, those who have a card and those who don't. We know that people who come into our door help us. We learn from them. Not just volunteers, but on a daily basis. Oh, I didn't know. I hadn't thought about this. This room is full of quotes from non-librarians to inspire both librarian and community member alike. If we buy into the simplistic approach that it is us versus them, that creates a whole problem. Don't live in the ambiguity. Enjoy the ambiguity. Swim in the ambiguity. Because when it comes time for supporting or cutting, in changing or adding, people are much more willing to support their neighbor, their friend, and their colleague than they are those that they use. How we do experience design, UX. A lot of approaches, once again, pulled from a commercial world which is about selling to them, come to the idea of being data-driven. And I love being data-driven until it drives you literally off a cliff. Now, you laugh, but I read this lovely article about people who quite literally followed their GPS to the point of off a cliff and into water. Now, a cliff I can imagine. You can't quite see it. Ah! Water? Well, I'm sure the road's coming any time now. Because we've become so dependent on data that we don't think. I had a colleague who used to work for U.S. Bank. How many people have ever had a credit card denied or you get this notice that says, "Are you really in Brooklyn?" Or more condescending way, "Are you really in Brooklyn?" Right? That comes from data. But here's the trick. Data mining, doing data exploration, statistics, really easy to find lots of correlations. Boy, these things seem related. But the most essential step in data mining is to look at those correlations and say, does that mean anything? It turns out that the most people who come to the Brooklyn Public Library's main branch on Thursdays are people who in the last 10 years have been on a sailboat. I don't know if that's true, but I'm sure that we can find the data, right? What does that mean? Does that mean we need to promote greater sailboat use on Thursdays? I mean, who cares? Kim Silk has a great line. She says, we need data to make our stories true. Well, we can tell great stories, but unless we can say this is replicable, this happens again, so what? But we need stories to make the data matter. So a lot of people have talked about moving statistics instead of, you know, this is our circulation, this was our gate count, moving to what are called magnitude or comparative level statistics. More people have come to the New York Public Library in the past year than went to all the baseball games, right? I saw this infographic. Brilliant infographic, right? Boston, I believe you guys did one similar. More people, you know, have gone to the Boston Public Library than have seen the Mona Lisa, et cetera. Because it tells a story at the same time that it tells data. And why? Because people are swimming in complexity. And this helps them with a narrative of how to move through when there aren't clear boundaries. So instead of looking at how we design our services, our systems, our spaces, our websites, by looking at where people go, let's spend some time with them. Where do we want them to go? Do we love the fact that they come to our homepage and leave? Do we love the fact that they totally missed this type of thing? Who determines that? That's a conversation. And input, surveys. Surveys are not bad, but they're hard. Many people do surveys because they think they're easy, but to do them well is hard. Ask Lee Rennie of the Internet Public Life. When they do those surveys on library and public usage, they have to deal with the number they talk to, the diversity, what zip codes they're going in, how many times they call them back within a time, how do they deal with different demographic shifts. It's a huge, important thing. So simply putting out an example, I'm on the DeWitt County Library Board, and we are moving the DeWitt County Public Library to Jamesville, New York. Now, it's in the service area, but the street name and the city is going to be different. So should we change our name to the Jamesville DeWitt Community Library? I said, hey, let's ask. Put it up on a survey. This is me doing a bad thing. Don't do this. Would you support changing the name to the Jamesville and DeWitt Community Library? Instant answers. Most of them, no. But then they started adding comments. And the comments were things like, I wouldn't call it the Jamesville and DeWitt Library because the school district is just Jamesville DeWitt Library. I just call it Jamesville DeWitt. If you don't structure the survey properly, if you don't spend the time to do that, as I did not, you don't get good data back. You get data. Data's great, right? It's like someone once said, I find that people who long for statistics tend not to care which ones we give them, right? She learned this because Suzanne Ripley, she would drive into the parking garage and she'd go, I forgot my pass. The guy said, well, can you give me the number on your pass? And she'd just sit there and go, 5, 9, 7, 6, 3, that's it. Oh, good, all right, right? We find this all the time. We have data. We got lots of data. Does it matter? Does it mean anything? We have to now talk about, just as we move from those complicated solutions of analysis of variance and independent variables to the notion of modeling and the notion of simulation. Where's the pop-up space? Where's the library that says, we're thinking of redoing the child space, so we have a room this big, and we're just going to try one, and you can come in and move it around. I call it a makerspace, not because it has 3D printers. I love makerspaces, but the idea is to make things, not necessarily just plastic things. We can make communities and conversations and structures. We can make physical layouts. We can make different layouts. We must engage our community because they are us and constantly try stuff out. A lot of librarianship, we don't want to, oh my God, if we move the reference desk over 5 feet, no one will have a question anymore. And if they don't have a question, guess what? Move it back 5 feet. I talk all the time about having communities. Communities come in and give sessions, right? So you have doctors and lawyers and firemen and policemen and butchers and architects. Have them come in and give a session about what it's like to be a butcher and an architect or an architectural butcher. It could be fun. And we bring, and by the way, have you seen those libraries that actually do butchering in the library?
Whoa.
All right. Talk about unique community needs. Anyway, they say, oh, but what if no one comes? And I say, is this the first library program you've ever put on that no one's come? And they say, yeah, but we'll be embarrassed in front of this person. I said, the only way that's going to work is if you say, we put together a program, show up today at 3 o'clock and go. If, on the other hand, the day they come in and say, I'd like to share this, you begin to say, well, what do you think about? What would your program be? Can you talk to where they own that program? Because then, instead of them standing up and going, no one came, you suck, they say, no one came, what could we do next time? How can we work on this? That's the difference between us and them. That's the difference between, well, we'll survey people if they care about architecture. Right? That's the difference between saying, what do you care about? What do you love? What are you passionate about? Let's make it happen. Right? Different complex approaches. Because ultimately, what we're talking about here is that librarians make complex systems. You are the complexity engine of your community. As businesses, as governments begin to reduce and pull back to solve complicated problems or develop simple or even complicated solutions, they are not yet good at developing complex solutions and complex problems. We try simple things. This is technological determinism at its best. I was talking to a colleague who will go unnamed, and she comes from computer science. And she said, and she developed an app that does human library-like activities, right? So you can sign up and say, well, yes, I would like to check out a book on architecture, and you talk to an architect, right? Ooh-ah, ooh-ah, ooh-ah. So we're talking about where she could take this next. And she goes, this could save libraries. And I went,
excuse me?
Yes, you see, if people realize that libraries are more than books, they'll come.
And your app's going to do that?
Yes.
Really?
And then she would say things like, you know, because, and then we need social, because the kids, they do the social. We were writing this grant. She wrote in, libraries need to sort of, in essence, fix themselves. I added it, don't worry. Fix themselves, because kids these days do social stuff and they don't read as much. I was like, I said, one, no! And that's, we have data that just says, no! Kids these days are reading more than they ever have before. It turns out it's diverse stuff. What a wacky thought. If you make things that, with characters that look like them, they read it. Wow! This is my Fozzie the Bear thing. I have colleagues that just drive me into Muppetum. I said, no, that's not it. And by the way, they do the social, they do the Snapchat. Why do they do the Snapchat? So that we don't see what they're doing. Duh! You want an app that they'll use? Just have it preloaded with naked pictures they can send to each other, and they'll use it. We build systems. We build systems based on motivation. Why do people want to do this? Do they do this because they want improvement? They want to make a better life for themselves or their children. They simply want to be happier. They were just curious. Do they do it because businesses make them do it or schools want them to do it? Why do we do it? We can understand that when people do something, that act, that behavior is not solely what they did. There's a whole world that goes behind it. So we understand their motivation. We need to understand access, not simply to stuff, but access to people and ideas and thoughts and opportunities. And that's where libraries, we have moved from a complicated access problem. How do we organize this materials and large volumes of materials for indexing and browsing and searching? To the complex problem, how do I get people into conversations and learning situations? How do I, when someone walks in and they want to know something, how do I not simply say, well, there's a book on it? How can I say, well, here are these 12 people working on the same problem? And how, when they come in and they say, you know, I love architecture, how do we say, let's get you podcasting. Let's get you a platform that you can build your own community. We understand now that access is not just to our stuff, but we're a platform that allows access across the whole world. We give a voice to a community that can now go beyond their house, can be on their neighborhood, beyond their city, to the entire globe. That is a complex problem.
Well, what about liability? What about language use? What about appropriate use? What about young children? What about minors? And we all know that pedophiles are waiting in the comment section on a public library discussion of Harry Potter. Right, how do we deal with this? Yeah, I'm saying that, and I'm not hearing laughter, which means at some point you've either had that conversation or you really now want to go read up on the Harry Potter trolls. Anyway, how do we deal with knowledge? I don't care if someone uses us. I don't care about use. I don't care if someone checks out a book. I would be the first person in the world who ever checked out a book and didn't read it before I returned it 3 weeks late. I would be, right? I care about did you learn. And not did you learn what I want. Did you learn what you wanted to learn? When people read fiction, they're learning. Not just how the text goes and how you can deconstruct it for a test or whatever. They're learning, I never thought I could do that. I love this book. I never thought I loved this kind of material. I never knew that culture had this kind of complexity. We're in the knowledge business. We're not in the information business, not in the thing business, not in the access business. We make our communities smarter. We make our communities make better decisions. That is a complex problem. And we build it in an environment. When I said privacy, those values, the things that we as librarians hold dear, if you're going to give up your privacy, you better know it. And you better understand the implications for it. Did you understand what an ethical use and treatment of this information is? Do you understand what it's like to commune, to literally be of a community, and what responsibilities are and actions? What we're talking about here is that librarianship solves the most complex problems we have in society, because ultimately the most complex problems that we solve is empowerment. That is to give people power. And you do not give people power unless you have power to give. Now, I want you to spend just one second on that, because I'll tell you, I've done this and I won't do it to you. How many people think that they are in the power business? Like one person who's striking me. How many people feel you empower? Everyone, I love it. How many people realize that empowerment, the root of it is power? If you want to teach someone to read, you have to read. If you want to teach someone to research, you have to know how to research. If you want them to have access to materials, you must have access to materials. Our communities and public libraries have given us power through our charter, through our budget, through our materials. They have entrusted us with the distribution of that power back to the community. We've traditionally looked at it as access to rare and expensive materials, but it truly is computer literacy, knowledge literacy, empowerment, identity, working, connecting. We're in the power business. And that means that we must solve the most complex problem of all, which is power is not neutral. Power is not objective. Power sees color. Power sees age. Power sees diversity. And we, as librarians, are dedicated and devoted around a set of metrics and a set of values and a set of principles and aspirations for our communities that sees diversity as power. That sees the more views you can bring to any problem, the better solution you will develop. That sees the more understanding that we can generate within a community, the more powerful it is. That no idea withers in the face of input, it blossoms. Ultimately, as librarians, these are the complex problems. Democracy, ruling ourselves, learning, listening, how we allocate power, how we understand who we privilege and who we do not privilege. No one is going to get out of poverty by writing the next app when you can't write an app on the phone. This is an instrument of power, and it is not my power. Technology access, people access, mobile hotspots, all of these things are our way of saying we believe in equity, we believe in diversity, we believe in our community's aspirations, and they will be different in Queens and Brooklyn and New York and Syracuse and Singapore. And that's okay. That's what it should be. Our libraries should, when people walk in from our communities, they should simply say, I am home. And that's a complex problem. And that is our value. Thank you very much for your time.